Now we've slipped mid-level because the countries who are serious have overtaken us. We are not joining the serious countries, and that's becoming increasingly apparent.
Which is why, Fraser, we're going to do a lot more on defence tomorrow on The Times at 1. But thank you, Fraser Nelson, for joining me today. And that's it for now. I'll be back at 1 p.m. tomorrow. But up next on Times Radio, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. Yeah,
we work to rule. We're not starting until two.
Okay. Times Radio. It's just coming up to 2 o'clock. It now is 2 o'clock.
It is, yes. Welcome. Between now and 4 o'clock, just how awful could April be? We're going to get the political reaction to the Chancellor's comments on the cost of living crisis. We'll also find out what it means for our finances. It is worth saying, of course, that in the last quarter of an hour or so, President Trump has said on Truth Social that the Iranians have asked for a ceasefire. That was a very recent bit of news, so we'll hope to bring you more on that a little bit later. We'll also check in on the Artemis launch in Florida. From today, Wales has a dedicated NHS gambling helpline. We're going to talk to the people behind it about why it's so important. And our big guest after 3:30 is Stig Abel, Times Radio breakfast host, of course, co-host right from the very beginning of the station. He's also a writer. His latest crime novel is out next week. And if you're a fan of Jake Jackson and his investigations, you'll definitely want to hear about it. That's after 3:30.
And all of that happens after the very latest news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. Donald Trump says the new supreme leader of Iran is calling for a ceasefire. The US president says he will consider the idea when the Strait of Hormuz is open, free and clear. Earlier, he said American attacks on Iran could be over within 2 or 3 weeks with or without a deal. Hosro Isfahani from the National Union for Democracy in Iran has told Times Radio he doubts that Trump will cut and run.
I don't think he would make such a mistake and go down in history for losing one of the greatest opportunities that the United States had for finishing the leading sponsor of terrorism. But even if he does that, the Iranian nation has proved over the past 5 decades that they are going to keep marching against the Islamic Republic. We have been doing it since the inception of this regime, and we are going to keep doing it until this regime is reduced to a blip in our history.
Donald Trump also says he's seriously considering taking the United States out of NATO. Member countries have been reluctant to help America reopen the Strait of Hormuz on Iran's southern border. Trump has told The Telegraph that NATO is a paper tiger, and while the US has helped in Ukraine, European countries should have done more in the Gulf. Noah Rothman, a senior writer on the National Review, has told Times Radio it's an alarming development.
Well, it's quite disturbing. The president can't simply unilaterally withdraw from NATO. It's a Senate-ratified treaty, and in 2023, Congress reaffirmed its ratification in a separate bill, contending that there can be no alteration to US status in NATO but through an act of Congress. But the president can complicate our relationship with NATO in ways that functionally render it defunct. He controls troop movements. He controls whether or not we respond to Article 4 or Article 5 invocations. And that's really serious.
The Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, has responded to Donald Trump's comments on international defence.
NATO is the single most effective military alliance the world has ever seen. Whatever the pressure on me and others, whatever the noise, I'm going to act in the British national interest in all the decisions that I make.
The head of the International Energy Agency says the reduction of oil supplies this month will be twice what it was in March. Fatih Birol says the biggest problem is the lack of diesel and jet fuel. He says that's already the case in Asia and will begin happening in Europe this month or next. Three more people have been arrested in connection with an attack on four ambulances owned by a Jewish charity in North London. The vehicles were set on fire in Golders Green. And the BBC says it sacked former Radio 2 breakfast presenter Scott Mills after new information about his conduct emerged in recent weeks. The corporation has also admitted it knew about a police investigation into Mills in 2017. Mills was questioned by police over historical allegations of serious sexual offences, but no charges were brought. He himself has not commented. And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Well, welcome aboard, class. Please do behave, even you at the back. It's 4 minutes past two. It's Jane and Fee with you until 4 o'clock. We've got plenty over the next 2 hours. Light and shade as ever, we hope. Let's look up at the night sky together and wonder. Artemis 2 sets off to do just that. We are live in Florida with Kaya Burgess ahead of the launch. Back here, it's awful April. Welcome to a month where your wallet takes a pounding. We've got all of those figures for you and hopefully some tips on how to minimise the rises coming your way. A very odd story emerged today. What on earth is going on up Everest? The Kathmandu Post has uncovered a network of scams. That includes making tourists ill with baking powder, so they feel they have to charter a helicopter to get them down the mountain. The money from that trip gets shared with the criminals who targeted the tourists in the first case. 33 cases are pending. Tom Whipple can explain a little bit more. Now, Scott Bryan really knows his telly, and we're going to talk Love Story, The Pit, and Scott Mills's fate at about 3:15. After 3 o'clock, we're going to talk about gambling addiction, because in Wales today, a new NHS helpline and treatment service for individuals and families is being launched. It does really recognise how dangerous gambling has become for so many people. If any of those stories interest you, then we'd love to hear your thoughts. We are 0333 003 2353. And then after 3:30, Times Radio listeners, be still your collective beating hearts. It's Stig Abel.
It's breakfast heartthrob. Stig Abel with us after 3:30, talking about his latest crime novel. It's called A Twist in the River. It's Jake Jackson, book number 4. Now, you've read the other. In fact, you've read all of them, haven't you?
I have read all of them, yes.
Yeah, I was new to the series, so
I've been on a Jake journey.
You have, and you've been very loyal to Stig. And it's noted. You've now said it a number of times in public. She's read all your books, Stig. I've only read this one.
I think you keep on asking me if I have, and I just have to answer honestly.
Well, I'm going to also just out myself as someone who's prepared to be a creep. I enjoyed it, Stig, and I'm very excited to be speaking to you after 3:30. He does cram quite a lot into his day, so I'm just bound to ask him how on earth he does it and where he finds the time to write these books, because he's written 4 since he started on The Breakfast Show. Then again, it's only 4 hours long, 4 days a week, isn't it? What am I saying?
It's 4 hours long.
Anyone
it's
do it.
Twice the length of this programme.
Yeah. 0333 003 2353 is the WhatsApp. If you've got any questions for Stig about his daily schedule and about his books, we'd love to hear from you this afternoon. Very much looking forward to that. Right, what are the most read stories on the Times website?
In at number 3, Times Radio's political editor Anna Mihailova's story about the MP wife of an alleged spy who's been reported for perhaps a drunken incident at a nuclear base. The second most read story, a pair who trashed a hotel and have now been banned from every pub, club and bar in the country. That story is worth your time just for the detail in it. And the most read piece on the Times website today, the Iran War live blog, with Donald Trump saying NATO is a paper tiger and not there for the US. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. That Iran War live blog constantly being updated. You just need a digital subscription. If you don't have one, everybody together.
Get one.
Yes, yeah. Thank you. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
That was under rehearsed, that little bit, I think. I really felt that. Right, let's go to the politics of the day. Donald Trump says that Iran's new leader has asked for a ceasefire. This was around about 1:45 our time this afternoon. But the US will only consider that ceasefire if the Hormuz Strait is open, free and clear. They are the words of Donald Trump. Now, there are fears the war in Iran will fuel another energy crisis, of course, with gas and electricity prices at risk of climbing again over the next 12 months. From today, a typical household will face an additional £216 on essential bills as what's being described as awful April begins to really bite. The PM we're speaking today, he says he wants closer ties with Europe to help tackle all the pressure while insisting the UK will not be dragged into the Middle East conflict.
It's not going to be easy, clearly. And in the coming weeks, as you would expect, we will continue to assess the economic effects. We will continue to stand up for the British national interest. And we will continue to do what we must to guide our country calmly through this storm. However, it is increasingly clear that as the world continues down this volatile path, our long-term national interest requires closer partnership with our allies in Europe and with the European Union. Now we have made progress on this front, on agriculture, electricity, emissions trading and more. But as the Chancellor has rightly pointed out, Brexit did deep damage to our economy and the opportunities to strengthen our security and cut the cost of living.
The Prime Minister, of course. Well, Terry Stiassny is our political correspondent, joins us now. First of all, Donald Trump's Truth Social post at about 1:45. I suppose are there grounds for optimism here? Is it possible that the Iranians have asked for a ceasefire?
It's possible. I mean, we haven't heard the response to that from Iran yet. Donald Trump saying that it's the new president who has asked for this, saying he's someone who is less radicalized than his predecessors, and also saying that one of the conditions for this would have to be opening the Straits of Hormuz. But Donald Trump's still got a threat in there. He's threatening that if that doesn't go ahead, then he would continue to bomb them back into the Stone Age.
Right. So mixed messages, I think it's fair to say, as ever. Let's talk about what our Prime Minister had to say earlier. I did hear Andrew Neil dismissing it somewhat, saying basically didn't learn very much. What do you think?
We didn't learn a lot that was new. I mean, when the Prime Minister calls a big press conference like this, you think maybe there's going to be a big announcement. But he was really going over a lot of the situation as it already is, talking about the plan for the immediate crisis. But these were all things like the energy bill, price cap, fuel duty that we already knew. And the Prime Minister himself said some people will say this isn't new, to which I say, yes, that's my point. And the point he was trying to make was that, well, we have planned this. This has been our sort of consistent approach over time. I think what we did learn, and you heard a bit of it in the clip there, was that he wants to have this closer relationship with the EU. He's planning to have another EU summit with Britain and the EU partners. Now, we knew one of those was due to be held this year anyway. So again, not entirely new, but really saying he wants to be more ambitious and have a lot more cooperation with Europe in terms of things like defence, security, energy and the economy.
Yeah. But at a time when the US president is saying, as he has said, that frankly, we've had enough of NATO, we might withdraw, Britain doesn't have any other option. Of course, it's got to cozy up to the EU, surely.
We have to. I mean, Keir Starmer was, pains to defend the importance of NATO after those comments by Donald Trump, calling it a paper tiger, saying it was the single most effective military alliance the world has ever seen. And he was trying to, again, he was trying to make the case that if you have this stronger relationship with Europe, then that would also help the relationship with the US, because the US has been saying, Europe needs to stand on its own two feet, effectively. But I think, it is really difficult. Keir Starmer was trying to say that he was resisting the noise and the pressure from outside, clearly meaning Donald Trump there, but saying we need to work with them on security and intelligence. But this is clearly, a sign that, from Starmer's point of view, you want to be working more closely with other countries in Europe, whether it's about reopening the Straits of Hormuz or the economy.
Right. I mean, is it still just toxic amongst some Labour voters to suggest just saying, look, Brexit hasn't worked for us, we're going to have to think about rejoining?
I think it's certainly been seen by some as a risk, because they worry about the so-called, red wall voters. Are these people who are more likely to go off perhaps and vote reform? But I think maybe if you can try to make the economic argument for it. And really, you know, as the Prime Minister was suggesting, that we're going to have these closer links, that there had been deep damage to the economy from Brexit, in his words. Maybe you think that people are a bit more persuadable.
Right. Well, that'll be interesting. Keep an eye on that then. What options does Keir Starmer have to help and protect the UK from the impact of the war? I mean, I know that some parties, the Tories and Reform, actually, are both calling for VAT to be removed from household energy bills. Could that happen?
I think that's unlikely. He seemed to be pushing a lot of these decisions further into way into the year. So, for instance, on fuel duty, he was saying this is fixed where it is until September. When he was talking about household energy bills, again, he was saying, look, they are going to be a lot lower over the summer anyway, partly because of the price cap, partly because people obviously use less heating, for instance, during the summer months. But I think both he and Rachel Reeves are trying slightly to say this is not a decision for now. This is one that we'll have to look at depending on how long the conflict goes on and depending what those impacts are.
Terry, thank you very much indeed. Our political correspondent, Terry Stiassny. Donald Trump is due to make a speech at about 2 o'clock tomorrow morning, our time, and you'll be able to hear that on Times Radio. I don't know whether he's going to repeat what he's already told us about the Iranians allegedly asking for a ceasefire or whether it'll be something else. But anyway, that's live 2 in the morning tomorrow on Times Radio. So let's bring in Megan Harwood-Baines, who's senior money reporter at The Times. Hello again, Megan.
Hi.
So the bills that are definitely going to rise over the next 4 weeks, what are they? And have they already actually come in, these changes?
Yeah, so there's a bit of bad news for people. It is the start of awful April. So from today, you're going to see your water bill go up, your council tax, phone bills, your TV licence, air passenger duty is going to go up. The good news is your energy bill is going to go down in the short term, but in 3 months' time, it's looking like that will be a very different picture. So kind of enjoy that while it lasts.
Yeah, because July is going to bring some bad news.
Yes, so it's looking like it will go down about 7% from today, but then from July it will go back up 18% because of everything that's going on in the Middle East.
OK, and can you explain the price cap? Because I do get a bit confused. It's not the maximum amount of money any household can be charged, is it?
No, that's what it's worked out based on an average, but it does cap the amount you pay per unit, if that makes sense.
Right, which it's not the same thing, is it? I mean, I no wonder people are confused. Basically, you're going to be paying more.
Yes, you're going to be paying more. And it is worked out based on, you know, if you're in a big family of five with lots of people in the house, you're going to be paying more than someone in a one-bedroom flat living on their own. But they give these sort of averages to give people a rough idea of where they can expect their bills to pay, okay, to be.
I think the problem with it is it's very difficult for us, just as consumers, to remember what the last price cap was, therefore the relevance of this price cap. There's got to be an easier way of telling us this, hasn't there?
Yeah, definitely. And I think it is very confusing because who knows how much they pay per unit of electricity and gas. I mean, I think my husband is about the only person on the planet who could tell you offhand what he's paying. So there's got
to
be
a... Well, make him energy secretary.
There must be a simpler way of...
It's weirdly confusing, that price cap thing. Mm-hmm. I never get it myself either.
Rachel Reeves is saying that the cost of living support, which will be provided, is going to be based on household income. Now, obviously people will criticise that and say, well, there's going to be, what is it, they say the Strivers are going to be subsidising the Skivers, and you could make that case. Of course, a lot of people on benefits are pensioners, for a start.
Yeah.
That's always worth emphasising, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And it's not going to be like last time when the war in Ukraine happened and we were all given £400 towards our energy bills. I think we were, in many ways, quite lucky in that respect. It's definitely not going to be like that again.
Right. This will mean that those people who really are up against it will get money. Presumably, the Liz Truss handout, we can't have come close to paying it back yet. I mean, that was loads and loads of money, surely.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that was budgeted in, but it was a significant amount of money for the country to pay. So you would hope that support is actually targeted at those who need it, because, and the same with pensioners, there will be wealthy pensioners who don't need it. And hopefully it will go to those who really do.
Okay. To individuals and households who are, frankly, a bit panicked, because mortgages are also an issue as well. Rent is a colossal challenge for a lot of people. What can you do now to make things just a little easier?
So there's a couple of things you can do, particularly with mortgages. So if you're looking to buy or to remortgage or to move house in the next 6 months, you can lock in your deal early. So you can basically agree to a deal with a lender. The good thing is if it then goes down between now and when you move, you can get a cheaper rate. But the best thing to do is probably look at when you're going to remortgage and start having those discussions with a mortgage broker.
Okay, and they'll be responsive, will they?
Yeah, so you have 6 months in which to do this, and you can do that any time in the lead up.
Because it's in their interest to help you, isn't it? Simple
yes,
as that.
Yeah, definitely.
And general bills, I guess with heating, it's not particularly cold at the moment. It's not especially warm either. We'll probably be able to get through to the autumn. But if things are still as they are now, then a lot of people are going to face a really grim winter.
Definitely. And I mean, there's a benefit for with your energy bill. If you continue paying the same amount through the year, what will happen is you'll start to build up credit on your account that you can use during the winter. So even though it's warmer, not dipping the amount that you pay towards your bills is probably a good idea to help build that buffer.
Even though it might seem ridiculous that you're paying a lot of money.
Yeah.
It does sometimes when I do check, and I do check with my energy provider, the money I've got in my on their system already on, you know, basically on their books, presumably money they are gaining interest on?
Yeah, I mean, I never try and let my energy provider have too much of my money. It's also worth saying that it's very difficult to cut someone off. So if you really fall into arrears, it is on the energy company to reach out and help you. It's, you know, you're never going to sort of hopefully wake up one morning and not have electricity, not have gas, because it is very difficult to cut someone off completely.
Thank you very much, Megan. That is Megan Harwood-Bain, Senior Money Reporter at The Times.
Charlie has sent us some details of, I'm assuming you're a him, Charlie, you might be a her, Charlie, details of the standing unit, no, I'm sorry, I'm going to get that wrong, the unit price on his heating, and that's done per half an hour. So upcoming rates table over a 48-hour period showing sorted by time. Now, you may understand that, Charlie. That leaves me even more bewildered about what's going up and what's going down. But I think a very sensible point is made by Helen, who says maybe it's helpful to think about how many units of energy we use and how we can reduce those when the unit price is high. Everything is further complicated by the expense of standing charges, which are way too high. We can't do anything, can we, about the price per unit we're being made to pay. The only thing we can do is change the number of units that we're using. And we just need to be incredibly mindful of that at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it really is as simple as, well, I mean, it's too, I hate it when people say just put a jumper on. Because that's, I mean, if you're older, perhaps not very well, and you spend a great deal of time not able to move around much, and you're in your own place most of the time, sitting there in six jumpers and a coat is no way to live your life, is it?
No, it's not. Any thoughts, though, on that? Any top tips, we'll take them. 0333 003 2353. Coming up.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
It's basically any excuse to play moon and planets related music. We're going to preview. God, I tell you what, don't tempt Ryan.
Play among the stars.
We will preview the Artemis launch live with our man in Florida. This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio. It is 20 minutes past two.
It's rowing's greatest rivalry. 197 years of history, drama, and sporting prowess. And this April, Times Radio will bring you live and exclusive coverage of the 2026 Oxford versus Cambridge boat race. Hear all the build-up to the race across the Times Radio schedule, culminating in a special programme on the 4th of April.
Listen to me, Jane Mulkerins, live from the boat race, this Saturday from 1 p.m. on Times Radio.
Official radio partner of the boat race.
In a world of noise and uncertainty, IG is the investment platform that backs you. Take our flexible stocks ISA, which gives you the freedom to withdraw funds anytime and replace them in the same tax year, all without losing your £20,000 tax-free allowance. And if that's not enough, pay no commission on your stocks, shares and ETFs when you invest with IG. IG. Trade. Invest. Progress. Your capital's at risk. Other fees may apply. Tax treatment depends on individual circumstances and is subject to change.
Happy Meal just got a cosmic boost because the Super Mario Galaxy movie has landed in cinemas, and Mario hasn't come alone. There's a whole galaxy for your little ones to discover. Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 4th of May, from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Okay, so we do know that the pedant klaxon has gone off because they're not putting a man on the moon, but NASA is looking to make history once again with the launch of Artemis 2. Liftoff is expected at 11:24 p.m. UK time. A team of astronauts will blast into space in the hope of flying around the moon and potentially travelling further from Earth than anybody has ever done before. And if REM could have fitted that into their lyrics, I think they would. Kaya Burgess is the Times' science correspondent, live at the Kennedy Space Centre for us. Kaya, we know that the line might be a little bit tricky and there is a tiny delay on it, so very simple. What makes this launch so special? Why is it so very different to Artemis 1?
Well, the big difference with Artemis 1 is that we have human beings aboard, and it's amazing to think that when the last Apollo mission left the surface of the moon in December 1972, so more than 53 years ago, human beings have been nowhere near the moon in the half a century since. But the International Space Station is barely above the top of the atmosphere. It's about 250 miles away. They can pop up there very easily. They're now going 1,000 miles further. It's a 500,000-mile round trip. And as you say, they'll go further beyond the moon and so deeper into space and away from our home planet than any human being has ever been before.
Can you describe where you are at the moment for those who cannot see the incredible backdrop?
So I am at the Kennedy Space Center, which is on Cape Canaveral on the Florida coast. If you can see the image behind me, you can see there's a big countdown clock, which has just gone over the 9-hour mark for the launch. And then just over my shoulder, for those who can see, a little spike on the horizon there, that is the SLS rocket. And as we speak, they're pumping liquid hydrogen and oxygen fuel into it. This is a really key moment when a technical hitch could happen that could delay the mission again. If they get through this in the next few hours, then shortly the astronauts will be making their way out to board the rocket.
Why do launch windows matter so much? Why do they have to be so specific about the liftoff time?
It really is only as technical as the moon needs to be in the right place, because the rocket launches into orbit around the Earth and then it launches into a higher orbit around the Earth. And it does what's called a translunar injection, which is the moment when the engines fire off and send humans into deep space, which we haven't done for 53 and a bit years. And the moon's got to be in the right place when you go if you don't want to just sort of whiz off forever into the cosmos. And so there's 5 or 6 days per month that are suitable.
Right, OK. The King has written to the Canadian astronaut on board, Jeremy Hansen, and I hope the others aren't upset by that. One of the things that he said is how he believes that space should not be conquered but should be a shared inheritance to be cherished and preserved. It's vital that the moon remains a beacon of peaceful scientific discovery. How is that going?
Well, one of the remarkable things with the 1960s space race, given it was the Cold War and given the competition on Earth between the Americans and the Soviets to assert their control over territory on Earth, treaties were signed way back then saying that no one could claim ownership of territory in space. They might want to stake out the best spot for a moon base where there's the best minerals and ice and whatnot, but they can't claim ownership of it. But it's an important thing to reassert now that China is involved in space races. Other countries are interested as well to reiterate the idea that people aren't going to try and claim land on the moon, to try and own anything, and that it's for science and sort of for the benefit of everybody. And I think that was the King's point that's why space exploration is important.
Who else is on the flight?
So we have three Americans. There's Reid Wiseman, who is the commander. There's Victor Glover, the pilot, and Christina Koch is one of the mission specialists, as well as Jeremy Hansen. And so there's a lot of firsts there. It's the first woman to travel into deep space, the first non-white astronaut, and the first non-American astronaut to travel into deep space as a four. And all the Apollo missions were three people. This is four, still only sharing a space for 10 days, about the volume of a Ford Transit van. So not a lot of privacy or much room to move around, but it will be absolutely fascinating.
So while they're up there, given that they are in such a confined space, how much research are they able to do? Or these days, is even a manned mission about the technology that they take up with them?
Well, this is different in the sense that the International Space Station is a floating laboratory. They go up there and there are stations on that space station for them to carry out all kinds of experiments in botany and cells and medicines and you know, all kinds of things. This mission won't have kind of science being carried out in that sense of experiments on board. The experiment here is the mission in the sense of, can this Orion spacecraft keep four astronauts obviously alive, but healthy and happy in their life support systems for 10 days? There's all the communications operators they're supposed to, and the engines and the oxygen supply. They've got spacesuits so that if anything goes wrong, they can climb into their spacesuits as kind of survival suits that would last them up to 6 days. So that is the experiment of this mission. And the next mission will be Artemis 3 next year, which will test out the landers in orbit around the Earth before Artemis 4 in 2028, supposedly, which will see human beings actually land on the lunar surface.
Wow. Now, I did ask you to describe the background that we can see behind you, Kyle, and I suppose the thing that I should say as well is that there are only kind of two or three people behind you, and I suspect more are gathering somewhere else in order to
if you've got a view, and you can see the video, that's the vehicle assembly building is behind me.
Yeah.
The biggest single story.
Okay.
And then you can just see this way. There are banks and banks. This is the kind of press area or people setting up kind of cameras. CBS News and NBC News have their own buildings with sort of rooftop points for their presenters and anchors and all around.
Now, we discover the reason.
People are taking out the best on the front pages.
Sure. We discovered the reason that you were standing in that very fixed position with the worst backdrop known to mankind for something as exciting as the Artemis 2 launch was because that's where the best signal was. And we are losing your signal a little bit, Kaya. But, I mean, enjoy every moment of this. What a fantastic thing to be able to witness firsthand, and we look forward to reading all about it in the Times and hopefully talking to you again, maybe even tomorrow, after what everybody is crossing their fingers to be is a very successful launch. That's Kaya Burgess at the Kennedy Space Center, still just called the Kennedy Space Center, worth noting at the moment. Because yeah. Everything else that's Kennedy does seem to get a Trump attached to it at the moment. So that's 11:24, Artemis 2 will launch.
Yeah. Claire does say, I think we all know that someone would like to own the moon, and I think we know what their name is. Yes, Claire, you're absolutely right. Alex, rather more cynically, just watch the film Capricorn 1 instead of watching the Artemis launch. Oh, come on, Alex. It's a good film, that, but do you know that film?
I don't know.
It's about a landing on Mars, I think, which doesn't actually happen. It's all in a TV studio or on a film lot. Oh, it's a spoiler, but it's a very, very old film. Anyway, I'm incredibly excited about this, and I think the astronauts are some of the bravest people. I can't imagine the courage required to do that, so very best of luck to them.
Can you imagine being for 10 days in a confined space with three other people no larger than a Ford Transit van?
No, to be fair, I don't think I'd find three people willing to spend that length of time with me in the equivalent of a Ford Transit van.
I'm busy.
Yeah, well, so you say. Okay, you are with Times Radio. We love hearing from you. Keep your messages coming. 0333 003 2353. Next, well, we've got text scams, phone scams, book scams. Now, would you believe it? Everest scams. You can't go anywhere these days. Nowhere is safe. Here are the headlines just after 2:30. Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Donald Trump says the new supreme leader of Iran is calling for a ceasefire. The US president says he will consider the idea when the Strait of Hormuz is open, free and clear. Earlier, he said American attacks on Iran could be over within 2 or 3 weeks with or without a deal. Hosro Isfahani from the National Union for Democracy in Iran has told Times Radio the Iranian regime plays games and Trump must finish the job.
This regime's playbook for international engagement has historically been de-escalation, true escalation, nothing else. And the world has taught them it's going to work. For the past 5 decades, the Islamic Republic has acted as a madman, and every time the world has backed down. Hopefully, President Trump is not going to back down this time.
Trump also says he's seriously considering taking the United States out of NATO. Member countries have been reluctant to help America reopen the Strait of Hormuz on Iran's southern border. Here, three more people have been arrested in connection with an attack on four ambulances owned by a Jewish charity in North London. The vehicles were set on fire in Golders Green. And two teenage girls have been arrested on suspicion of assaulting an emergency worker in southwest London. The Met Police has reported large crowds causing antisocial behaviour in Clapham. A dispersal order was issued last night. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
All right, we've got Simon on the line. Simon, young people, they're just all a bit lazy, aren't they?
What do you think?
Welcome to McDonald's.
Can I get a six minutes, please?
Of course.
Some say young people are work shy. But at McDonald's, we hired 47,000 of them last year.
Thank you very much. How's your night?
Like George here, who keeps things running during a Friday rush. Resilience. Making it happen at McDonald's.
You're listening to Times Radio, where conversation goes beyond the headlines. When it comes to advertising, is your business showing up in environments where it's taken seriously? Or are you relying on word of mouth alone? Join us at the Times Radio advertising event in May. You'll receive a custom campaign for your business, event-only prices, and free creative designed to reflect the quality of your brand. Register now at newsrsvp.co.uk/radio. Stop relying on word of mouth alone and start being heard.
Wake up to a brighter breakfast. Times Radio Breakfast, 7 days a week from 6 a.m.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
That's what they do on breakfast, isn't it? Where Stig and Kate, that was a tribute to our guest at Hopper's 3, Stig Abel. Because after 9 o'clock, they play a game of...
Who dares wins? Who's not going to speak first?
Just thought I'd play it. Sean says, wonder what they'll do with their waste food on the space mission. That's a very good point, isn't it? We were talking about food waste yesterday. Perhaps Jane could send her rancid bananas as a contribution to science. Okay, Sean, I will.
Mm-hmm. I think space is probably full of half-eaten meals, isn't it? It's probably the best place if you don't like your vegetables.
Chuck them out.
They're never going to bother you again.
Watch that.
Or are they?
Watch that bit of broccoli float off into the ether.
John Pienaar is here. Save everybody from us at 4 o'clock. What will you start with?
Well, I mean, I've got to start with a rant. With what? Just under 11 and a half hours from President Trump's big address in the Oval Office to America and the world. And... you know, it is a must listen, a must watch. I don't know, because nobody does, whether when we hear President Trump, it's going to leave us any less confused than we are now.
Yeah, we agree with that, John.
I mean, in the meantime, there's plenty to keep us confused. Just in the last hour, he's told us that apparently the president of Iran, or the new president, there isn't a new president, but he says the new president of Iran has been in touch, asking for a ceasefire. He said, no, you've got to open up the Hormuz Strait. This is just less than a day after saying he doesn't need a deal. He doesn't care whether the Hormuz Strait is opened up, pointing to a quick end to the war. So there's enough there to chew on in a confused way. And I'll be talking to a lot of people coming at it from a lot of different directions. And they include the former chief of staff to Donald Trump, Mick Mulvaney. I'm talking to the former national security advisor to President Trump, John Bolton. I'm talking to a former Obama senior official, Jennifer Garvito. And Jamie Shea, who's a Brit, he was a former deputy assistant secretary at NATO. They will all be sharing their wisdom on what is going on, if it's possible for anyone living to know that. I suppose they'll have a stab at it. I don't guarantee results from those conversations, but I think they're going to be helpful in getting our head around what we don't know, as well as what we do know, because that's always useful.
Yeah, it's exhausting though, John, isn't it?
It's exhausting. It's what we do. We sort of signed up for this fee, didn't we?
You're right, we did, to be fair.
Yeah.
And if you want to hear Donald Trump live in the middle of what probably will be your night, realistically, 2 a.m, you'll be able to hear it on Times Radio.
Tourists being poisoned with baking soda, criminal gangs operating insurance scams, hospitals admitting patients who aren't even ill. What is all of this? The plot of an ITV daytime drama? Nope, it's the reality of climbing Everest. The Kathmandu Post has uncovered a vast network of scams being carried out on the mountain. Hundreds of fake rescues have been happening at a massive cost to insurance companies. Well, Tom Whipple has been writing about this in the Times today. I spoke to him earlier. I simply asked him, what on earth's going on, Tom?
It is completely bonkers. I mean, so Everest is a huge money spinner already for Nepal. You get a lot of extremely rich Westerners turning up and they spend a lot of money. They buy permits to climb it. They do base camp. There is this great flow of tourist money that arrives about now because this is Everest season. This is when the weather's right, it's not too cold, it's not too wet, and you can get up to base camp and you can get up to the summit. So this is peak profitability, but just as this season opened, there's been this astonishing revelation from the Nepali authorities that they have uncovered a massive criminal network, effectively, there to find other ways to extract money from tourists. They're using organised crime laws to bring it down. And it involves scamming insurance companies. It involves the Kathmandu Post had a wonderful way of describing it, where it said that effectively, what you're doing is you're creating a fake rescue. They called it a fake rescue racket. And they said the mechanics of the fake rescue racket are straightforward. Stage a medical emergency, call in a helicopter, check a tourist into hospital, and file an insurance claim that bears little resemblance to what actually happened. And the most important bit of that is a helicopter rescue. Because if you can get a tourist down on a helicopter and charge for the helicopter, particularly if you can get lots of tourists down on the same helicopter and have each of their insurance claims charging for an individual helicopter ride, for the full cost of the helicopter ride, suddenly you've made thousands of pounds. But the most extraordinary part about all of this is sometimes the Nepali police are saying the tourists are deliberately made sick. They are, for instance, have their food spiked with baking soda so that they exhibit some of the symptoms of food poisoning and altitude sickness, and at which point the guides can step in and say, it's time for you to get your helicopter rescue.
Right. Let's pull back a tiny bit, though, because also there must be the implication that sometimes the tourists are in on this too.
Yes. So there are several mechanisms for this. So in some cases, what the Nepali authorities are saying is that tour guides will say to tourists who've gone all the way to base camp, which is, I've been there, you know, it's high, it's higher than Mont Blanc, they'll say, you've done a nice trek, you're tired. Rather than using your own two legs to go down, if you just pretend you're sick, then we can get you a helicopter. So that would be the tourists involved. There are also allegations that perhaps tourists reach there, they get altitude sickness, as loads of people do, and rather than just descending and resting and going gradually and slowly, they're convinced that what they need is a helicopter rescue down. So there are all sorts of shades of this. And then, of course, when they get down, in some cases, we don't know how witting or unwitting it is. In some cases, the hospitals will be filing for all sorts of CT scans and treatments that don't actually happen. The Nepali documents talk about tourists who are apparently extremely sick, who are then pictured having a celebratory beer when they arrive back in Kathmandu. So, yes, it feels like there's a lot going on, and there's been 33 charges laid.
Right. Just put that into numerical context for us then. If there are 33 charges that have been laid over what kind of period of time? How often is this happening?
This refers to about 3 years in which they recorded at least, they say, 300 fake rescues. And the level of the fraud was approaching $20 million.
Wow. And actually, that means 100 cases, potential cases a year. So that is basically this happening every one in 3 or 4 days. That is a lot, Tom, isn't it?
Well, it's actually a lot more than that because it's so concentrated into this one season. I mean, most of the year, we're familiar with the pictures of Everest and the summit overcrowded. That's, you know, a week of the year. Most of the time, this mountain's pretty empty. So, yeah, it's very much I think of when the sort of crocodiles of the Maasai Mara get this one great wildebeest migration and they all gorge themselves. And there's an element of that on Everest as well. There is these very, very tight windows when you need to get as much money as possible.
How easy is it going to be to stop this kind of practice?
Well, the difficulty is that, and I should say, look, I mean, it makes it sound like everyone's out to scam the tourists. This has been led by the Nepalese, who are appalled by what's going on. And there are lots of, you know, great local Sherpas who are there just trying to give tourists a wonderful time. But in terms of stopping it, the difficulty is that the insurance companies are so far away. They don't have auditors on site. Often helicopter rescues are ordered before getting approval, simply because of the nature of what goes on a mountain, that in legitimate circumstances, you just have to do it. So it's going to be hard, but it'll be interesting to see whether these charges and this increased attention to it will change things for, you know, because it's a wonderful mountain that's got a great history, and we do spend a lot of time talking about overcrowding and rubbish, but ultimately it's actually pretty clean, and it's a fantastic mountain, and it means a lot to a lot of people, not least Nepalese. So hopefully, you know, they'll find a way.
The act will be cleaned up. Just a tiny detail, Tom, I didn't know you could make people ill using baking powder. What does baking powder do to you?
I didn't know this either. According to the reports I've read, it mimics some of the symptoms of food poisoning and altitude sickness. But this is a new piece of information. News you can use, I guess.
No, let's not use it. Let's really never use it. Another detail, how much is a helicopter to get you from a camp somewhere up Everest back to a safer place? How much would that cost you?
This I don't know. I have, despite actually having taken a helicopter down from Everest myself.
Did you get a freebie? Because you're a journalist.
The planes weren't flying because the weather was too bad. Typically in the Alps, I know that these are several thousand pounds just for a very, very short route. It would depend where you're picked up on as well. If you're picked up from above base camp, then that's going to be an emergency and it's going to be very, very pricey. There are semi-regular ones to base camp, although Nepal's been trying to cut down on those as well. You're talking in the thousands. For one helicopter ride, for a private charter, I've just Googled it, it's 5,000-6,000, but that's a chartered one that you're planning.
Right. And a final thought. I don't really climb mountains. I look at a mountain and I think that's a mountain over there. I've got absolutely no desire to ascend it. As someone who clearly loves mountains and looks at a mountain and doesn't think that, what does it feel like when you're up there? Can you and did you feel on Everest that you had genuinely found something completely different, looked at the land in a different way?
So I should say for Everest, I didn't go beyond base camp simply because if you set foot on the Khumbu icefall above it, you have to pay many thousands of pounds. I was there to cover the 50th anniversary of, or the 60th anniversary, I think, of the first ascent. I absolutely love mountaineering. I'm not very good at it. The thing that I love is being alone, being with someone you really trust, and having a sort of sense of camaraderie and solving problems yourselves and being somewhere utterly beautiful. I don't particularly understand why a lot of people go to Everest. It feels to me like the Himalayas is a thing you go to once you've done everything else, because you're going to spend several months with a headache climbing something that's far higher than humans should really be at. So the mystification to me was a bunch of people who actually hadn't really, you know, even got up the north face of Everest. The north face of Ben Nevis, suddenly deciding that Everest was what they wanted to do. So it's a slightly strange mountain, but if people want to do it and they want to have fun, then off they go. There are some utterly beautiful peaks around it, like Amadablan, that are almost, you know, never climbed comparably, which I think I'd far rather be up.
I think the general message there from Tom was, you do you.
But he said it in such an erudite way.
He did. And I love that phrase as well. Just spend a couple of months with a headache. That is Tom Whipple. It's a fascinating article, though. You can read it in today's Times. We freaked Debs out. I'm horrified that space may be filled with outcast broccoli slowly manifesting sentience. The Triffids really bothered me in the 1960s on TV, obviously. But the prospect of broccoli, perhaps in alliance with the odd rancid banana, unleashing the wrath of the thoughtlessly abandoned, is really freaking me out. I tell you what, Debs, that is just a beautiful couple of sentences, though.
I hope you are a writer, Debs, and yeah, if you're not,
start.
Become one. Talking of which, Stig Abel is our guest this afternoon after 3:30. Novelist, Times Radio breakfast co-host since the station started. So you'll be looking forward to hearing from him a little bit later. But next, here on Times Radio, at 12 minutes to 3, we're going to talk telly and media news with Scott Bryan. That's next.
Late nights on Times Radio with Times Holidays. Listen to Times Radio every night from 10 for a first take on the stories making the headlines. Plus, explore the wider news agenda with thought-provoking guests from across politics, business, the arts and more. It's your dream nightly destination for the finest mix of news, culture and conversation. Late nights on Times Radio with Times Holidays. Explore, plan and now book the perfect holiday inspired by the journalists you trust. Search Times Holidays.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Experience. It's knowing when something is worth waiting for and when it isn't. That's why Saga Health Insurance offers unlimited GP appointments whenever you need them. With a choice of flexible plans, prompt tests and treatment, your health is taken care of. And right now, you'll get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Anonymous has a conspiracy theory. Let's indulge ourselves, shall we? Did Neil Armstrong actually say leap and mankind? Or did he use swear words and was dumped by Mission Control as the transmission does break up a bit? We only have his word. The quote is exactly what we know. Well, of course, he got the quote wrong, didn't he?
It was meant to be?
A giant leap for
a man.
Yeah, rather than he said man.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, look, talk about being under pressure.
But also, I think
we'll let him have it.
Neil Armstrong's line back to Mission Control was better than our line from Kaya Burgess to us.
That's
so
true.
I think we need to maybe dial down that particular conspiracy theory.
Although, actually, it just adds to the conspiracy theory, doesn't it? If we can't get a radio line over to Florida, how come they were able to land in the moon, on the moon in 1969? You know what I'm saying?
You're absolutely right. There's a shadow falling over my theory. Get it?
Right. 0333 003 2353. The BBC has confirmed it was aware of an investigation into the Radio 2 breakfast host, Scott Mills, back in 2017. Now, we're going to talk briefly about this to Scott Bryan, who's our TV and entertainment expert. Although increasingly, Scott, I'm sure you're fed up to the back teeth with having to talk about stuff like this.
It has been sort of a mainstay of my career over the last year. It's been mostly talking about talent, mostly being removed from their jobs, and mostly about the implications of it. I think, you know, obviously, I think the British public are probably quite tired of it. But I think the person who's probably most tired is Tim Davey. This is his last week as BBC Director General.
Yes.
And I can only imagine the thoughts he was having when that news started to be on his intray, just as he was on his way out after he had made speeches talking about his legacy and what he hoped for next DG would be prioritising. I've never known a director general to have faced so many related talent issues in such a short space of time. A lot of them just circumstantial, you know, just something that has just happened out of the blue.
Yeah, I mean, none of them his fault. I mean, I think we could probably all agree on that. There's going to be an interim director general for a while, isn't there? And the new guy takes over in May, I think.
Yes.
Can we talk about a little bit about the Scott Mills situation? It is a bit of an odd one, and he hasn't been found guilty of anything. He's lost his job. He's been sacked. It's been pretty brutal and extremely public. Do we know where we're at with this, and what is the BBC saying today?
So he has a statement from the BBC around lunchtime. I mean, this is off the back of tabloid reporting over the course of the last few days. And then BBC News have been sort of confirming these details, really. And the latest is that essentially they had information over the course of the last week that made them decide to remove Scott Mills from The Breakfast Show, and that they were aware in 2017 of the existing existence of an ongoing police investigation, which closed in 2019. So they knew about the police investigation that was launched in Scott Mills about 10 years ago. Now, from other reports, we have heard from the Director General at the time, Tony Hall, that he did not know about this. So I think there's a big question about, you know, who at the BBC knew about the police investigation then. I guess kind of the decision-making about why it was seen to be right for Scott Mills to continue in his role then too. And then subsequently, what is the new information? If the BBC already knew about the police investigation, that has now led to Scott Mills losing his job. Now, the BBC has said, you know, we have to limit the amount of information we can give out publicly because of the rights of those involved. But, I mean, the coverage of this has been by the hour, as you know, and this has been the case in which there has been already a great deal of speculation, which no doubt has not helped.
Yeah.
But also the fact that the BBC is giving very limited information into regards to the circumstances behind this case has added to that speculation. So you can see how we've ended up in this situation. Now, my firm belief is that the it will always come out in the long term. You know, give it a few days. We had this with all matter of other stories in regards to talent before. We find out in the course of the week. But I think for everyone involved, it doesn't help in the short term when there is such limited information and when speculation online is so rife.
Right. Well, we'll leave it there. And let's actually go back to your day job and television. Love Story. Now, Fee's a big fan. It's become Disney Plus's most streamed drama ever.
John, I want to introduce you to Carolyn Bessett. Carolyn, this is John Kennedy.
How old were you when you realized you were the son of a president?
I don't think anyone's ever asked me that before.
Shiny people, they belong to everyone.
A happy couple doesn't sell papers.
There isn't enough exposure in the world to prepare a woman to be your wife.
It's not a question of if I want to spend the rest of my life with you. It's a question of if I'm cut out to be Mrs. JFK Jr.
You have enjoyed this, haven't you?
Well, I think enjoy might be a...
You have watched this.
Yeah, but a little too much. It is engrossing and a bit unswitch-offable because it is so unapologetically schmaltzy, Scott. But there's a kind of feeling of guilt in watching it and wanting to enjoy it because ultimately it's a really sad story, isn't it?
It is. I mean, Caroline Bessette and JFK Jr. both died in a plane crash, I think at the turn of the millennium. I didn't know about this story before watching it, really. I sort of had it come in just because I think, I mean, Ryan Murphy, the creator, showrunner of this, he is known for shows that are unapologetic in the genre that they are in. You know, if it is American Crime Story, it is really going into the small detail. If it's about horror, it's incredibly gory. If it is about Love Story, it's incredibly schmaltzy. And I think it's the fact that what you have here is, you're right, it's a love story that is very easy to follow. I would say doesn't look into politics and society with the same richness as you would expect in, let's say, other series like The Crown. But looks great, has an absolute banging soundtrack, and has good chemistry between the two leads. I mean, like a lot of other Ryan Murphy shows, it has caught a controversy. One of the characters in this is still alive and has said that they don't see this as a reflection of what actually happened. I think Ryan Murphy has always, in recent years particularly, taken liberty with some elements of the plot for entertainment's sake. I think that's quite clear. But this is a bona fide hit for Disney Plus. I mean, it's been gaining viewership with each episode that there has been. They've been dropping these episodes weekly. And also, I think it's the case that it's very different to a lot of TV that's on at the moment. So that's kind of why it works. Annoyingly, I think I've been watching these episodes in bulk just to kind of get through it. But in a weird way, I quite like the closure.
Right. OK. And at least it's a bit of escapism, albeit escapism with a tragic end. Now, The Pit, I think that's relatively new to British viewers, isn't it? It's a Noah Wiley show. He plays Dr. Robbie, lead physician in the A&E department of a hospital in Pittsburgh. This, of course, is the actor who's best known for his leading role as Dr. Carter in ER.
Westbridge Hospital has shut down all the computer systems.
Are we next?
We're about to go analog.
You're a very empathetic soul, but this is the easiest, not for the faint of heart.
What do you need to get some basic empathy back?
We all need help from time to time.
Be an occasional miracle.
The most important thing?
I could use a second set of hands!
Because I will never stop offering.
I tell myself that every day.
Right, I've been told that this is astonishingly graphic, Scott. Will I be alarmed?
It is. I am the most squeamish viewer imaginable, and I had to take my headphones out because the sound alone was enough for me to bear, genuinely. It is great, though. I mean, I think what I like about it, it's a bit like 24, the Jack Bauer series, but with medicine. Each episode is basically an hour. It's set in an A&E department. But if you normally watch a lot of US medical dramas, they're very good at this, but they tend to be quite far removed. I mean, in terms of like Grey's Anatomy, really high stakes, you have to believe your truth at the door. With this, it feels very realistic, including the gore, including the dark side. And I think it's the case that it feels remarkably human, not only with the patients who come in, who have their own stories about how they have ended up there, and a lot of them are really interesting. I think it's also about the doctors and the physical and mental toll if you're having to see gory things over and over and over and over again. I thought it's great. And yes, a long wait. It's been 441 days from when it's been shown in the US to when it's been shown in the UK. But you might want to pace the episodes because it's a lot to endure in one episode.
Okay, it's HBO Max, isn't it? Is that correct?
It is, yeah, but if you watch on Now TV, it's on there too.
Oh, is it? Okay, right. Thank you for that. And I gather that occasionally patients just raise the worrying prospect of how much the treatment's going to cost them, which is that it? Do they?
Makes you thankful for the NHS, definitely, because.
Yes, quite. Thank you very much, Scott.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio. The voice of the times.
All of that takes us to 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. Still to come, why Wales from today has a dedicated gambling helpline, why England couldn't beat Japan on the football pitch, and why Stig Abel likes to present 4 hours of breakfast radio and then write detective novels in his spare time, all after the latest news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. Donald Trump says the new supreme leader of Iran is calling for a ceasefire. The US president says he will consider the idea when the Strait of Hormuz is open, free and clear. He says on True Social that until then, we are blasting Iran into oblivion or, as they say, back to the Stone Ages. Meanwhile, Trump says he's seriously considering taking the United States out of NATO. Member countries have been reluctant to help America reopen the Strait of Hormuz on Iran's southern border. Trump has told The Telegraph that NATO is a paper tiger, and while the US has helped in Ukraine, European countries should have done more in the Gulf. Noah Rothman, a senior writer on the National Review, has told Times Radio that Trump is not necessarily wrong on this.
The president has a point, and I'm very reluctant to give him the credit for it, but it is true. If the United States cannot rely on access to our allied air assets, it cannot transit airspace in places like Spain and Italy because it's engaged in a military operation against a shared adversary. Well, that does change calculations in Washington.
The head of the International Energy Agency says the reduction of oil supplies this month will be twice what it was in March. Fatih Birol says the biggest problem is a lack of diesel and jet fuel. In Australia, the Prime Minister says he's cutting fuel duty because of the Iran war. Anthony Albanese is encouraging people to use public transport.
Over the coming weeks, if you can switch to catching the train or bus or tram to work, do so. That builds our reserves and it saves fuel for people who have no choice but to drive. farmers and miners and tradies who need diesel every single day, and all those shift workers and nurses who do so much for our country.
Three more people have been arrested in connection with an attack on four ambulances owned by a Jewish charity in North London. The vehicles were set on fire in Golders Green. The BBC says it sacked former Radio 2 breakfast presenter Scott Mills after new information about his conduct emerged in recent weeks. The corporation has also admitted it knew about a police investigation into Mills in 2017. Mills was questioned by police over historical allegations of serious sexual offences, but no charges were brought. He himself has not commented. And a museum in Essex will be the first in the world to exhibit what may be a new species of dinosaur. When it stalked the Earth about 154 million years ago, the Juliosaurus weighed 600 kilograms and was more than 6 metres long. It'll go on display at Holly Trees Museum in Colchester on Friday. And for a roundup, the news on demand, find the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Massive ongoing discussions in the studio about whether or not we should open an Easter egg today or tomorrow. Jane and I aren't even here next week, so we definitely can't leave it till then.
No.
And we've decided what?
Well, we both decided we wanted to do it now, and we've been told we can't. And we've been palmed off with a small bag of so-called mini eggs.
Okay.
Pathetic.
It is. Anyway, these are the type of things that start to really trouble us by 3 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon. But we know that there are more troubling things out there in the world. We will talk about some of those in the next hour of the programme. Vassos comes in to do the sport, and then Stig Abel comes in to tell us about his latest Jake Jackson detective novel after 3:30. We're going to start, though, by taking a look at gambling addiction. An NHS helpline and treatment service for dealing with gambling issues is launching in Wales. The aim is to improve access to specialist treatment to ensure that people can receive the right support at the right time. Let's talk to Jodie Morgan, who is the clinical operational manager for All Wales Gambling Treatment and Helpline Services, and she helped to set up the new line. Jodie, a very good afternoon from us.
Hi, good afternoon.
Tell us a little bit more about the helpline and why the launch is so significant. Is it one of the first times that the NHS has funded a helpline specifically for gambling problems?
It is, yeah. It's the first All Wales NHS helpline service. And it's the first time that we have had a dedicated Welsh language and Welsh service for those in Wales who are suffering from a gambling harm. I think that it's a real huge step forward. So anyone previously in Wales has had access to services, but they have been in a multiple number of other areas. So it's really important that within Wales we have this opportunity to offer a service to those that need it, that can converse in either their first language being Welsh or in English. And that's really huge and really important for individuals to have the ability to access that.
Sure. Can you just put into context for us how big a problem gambling is in Wales?
Yeah, it affects thousands of people. I think it's really fair to say that not only does it affect thousands of people who are actually gambling, it affects the families, the loved ones, colleagues and people around those individuals. There is so much hidden harm in terms of gambling. It often goes unnoticed for a significant period of time. And I think that an individual can be suffering in silence really for a long time before the telltale signs start showing and they maybe start wanting to reach out for support. But I think this is why this helpline is so vital, because not only is it helping those individuals who are gambling, but it's helping anyone that's around them that may need support and how to either navigate their own feelings and their own emotions that come with that, or how to support their loved one.
Yeah, we're going to go on actually to talk to the chief executive of ADFAM, a charity that deals with families who are encountering a loved one with gambling and drink and drug problems too. So I wonder whether we could just focus a little bit on the people who are gambling, Jodie. And I would presume that there is no particular demographic, there is no particular age range. It really can be anybody now, can't it?
Absolutely. It doesn't discriminate against age, sex, anything. It's absolutely anybody can. If they believe that they are suffering from a harm relating to their gambling, then the helpline is there for them, and likewise the treatment service. So we are open to anybody who wants to refer themselves, or anybody that wants to phone to access support, or anybody that is supporting can refer. So any professional that is involved with an individual who may be gambling can refer that individual in. But we are open to anybody to either have treatment or to support over the telephone. And if you believe you are affected, then give us a call. Sure. And refer yourself.
And Jodie, what and where are you referring people onto? Because we know that the NHS does not have unlimited funds and resources at the moment. So can you be certain that when somebody calls in distress, there is going to be another place they can go to that will actually be able to help them?
Yes, so part of what's running alongside the helpline is a treatment service that is currently, that's also active from today. We are accepting referrals for anybody that needs ongoing support. And we are developing a workforce aligned to that, which is very much focused on psychology and support aligned to that. So we are committing to supporting that. We will have a skilled workforce in place that are able to support people long term. We do have a number of agencies, third sector agencies, of which we are linked into to support onward referral once people are at that stage after the treatment and they want that long-term recovery. So there are agencies out there who will offer that continued ongoing support. Like you said, we've not got unlimited resources, but we are really confident in terms of the workforce that we do have and that we will be recruiting that will meet that need that we understand to be there.
Jodie, thank you for explaining that. That's Jodie Morgan, who has helped set up this new helpline in Wales. Let's talk now to Viv Evans, who knows all about how crucial support services are. She is the CEO of the charity AdFam. Hello, Viv.
Hello, Fee.
Can you just explain a little bit more about what AdFam can offer?
Well, we offer a service, a remote service. It's called AdFam at Home. And that is a structured intervention. There are six sessions of one-to-one support that help the family member, friend, whoever it is, whatever relationship they have with the user, help them to understand what's going on, to understand the nature of addiction, to understand and to get support for themselves in terms of helping them to set strategies so they can set boundaries, they can deal with conflict, they can deal with family breakdown, and help to build the family together. Yeah. And that's a remote service on Zoom or on a telephone, and it's run by our family support workers who are all have counselling skills and are trained, highly trained, experienced individuals who can offer this service. It's unfortunate. I mean, we have a service, a specific service for anyone affected by someone's gambling, and that is linked to the NHS clinic in the West Midlands. So I would love to have, like Jodie, I would love to have a national service, because I really, really think it's needed.
Sure.
This problem is so stigmatized and hidden, and you know this.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that we should really talk about that. It's exactly what Jodie mentioned as well, that it's an addiction that you may not know about until somebody is so far down the road. It's not like drink, where you might have seen somebody drunk or hungover. It's not like drugs, where you might have seen somebody high and out of control. Your loved one might have a gambling addiction, and you simply have no idea until it is very, very serious indeed.
Yeah, and what family members tell us when they're affected by a loved one's gambling is that shock is one of the key emotions. So coming to terms with this is, as you say, perhaps even more difficult than coming to terms with someone's drinking or drug taking. And it's the relationship breakdown that we have found is perhaps one of the most specific issues faced by someone someone affected by a loved one's gambling. It's that total loss of trust. You know, you think straight away, oh, it's the financial implications that are huge, which of course they are. But what family members tell us is that it's the relationship breakdown, the loss of trust and the shock that they experience that is really, really critical.
Yeah.
And that's what we can do to help them to come to terms with that and develop some strategies for their own, to help their own coping, develop their own strategies to deal with this.
I want to just mention a message we've had from Simon, who says, I really don't understand why TV ads for gambling don't have to show lots of people losing money and having problems. After all, investment ads have to state that capital is at risk. I can only conclude that the gambling lobby remains all powerful. It's a really good point to make, isn't it, Viv? And actually, the gambling ads that you see on TV now will frequently have somebody, yeah, a famous person, halfway through looking cheekily at the camera and saying, oh, take a day off. They're advertising, yeah, the product that is harming the person who needs, yeah, to take a day off. What do you make of them?
Yes, and I mean, I see a lot of them because I watch a lot of football. I think there should be some kind of advertising ban. There should be similar, if not more stringent measures than there are around alcohol advertising and I think introduction of junk foods. I think we really, and you know, we don't see smoking adverts anymore. I really think that, and we know from the evidence that advertising is a key influencer for behaviour, addictive behaviours, and talking of gambling here. And I would like to see them, well, I'd like to see adverts totally banned, to be quite honest.
You would know much more, yeah, about the power of the, yeah, gambling lobby than most people, I suspect, Viv. So what would you say about it? I mean, is it one of those lobbying forces that actually, in future, when we come to realise how powerful it was, like the cigarette manufacturing lobby, the tobacco industry lobby, we will be rather horrified by it?
Yes, probably. And I mean, alcohol industry is very powerful as well. Yes, I mean, I think the government, if I'm right, and Jodie probably knows more about this than me, that the government is doing its best to restrict the influence of the gambling industry, and has recently launched new funding opportunities for the NHS and third sector organisations to deal with this and to prevent problem gambling. But yes, I mean, I totally agree. I think a lot more should be done to curb the influence of the industry in all addictions, not just gambling,
yeah,
but in all addictions.
And yeah. Viv, are there any signs to really look out for if you think that you know somebody who might be experiencing difficulties with gambling? What would we be looking out for?
I think the secrecy element, you know, I mean, it's easy to say you could look at the bank balance and see, you know, what has been withdrawn, and that would be a practical step. But it's the deception that comes with this addiction. Somebody who's gambling will be deceiving their partner, their loved one, people in their family, people close to them. They're not. It's unlikely that they're going to be saying, oh, you know, I bet so much yesterday on whatever and I lost so much. They're not going to be revealing it. So it's very, very hidden more than other addictions, I think. As you said earlier, Fee, you know, you know if somebody's drinking too much, it's likely that you do, or drug taking. But this one is very, very concealed. And that's why it's so much of a shock when someone finds out about it. And they're probably only going to do that by confronting the gambler. And that then could well lead to relationship breakdown. because of the implicit deception that's been going on. That doesn't really, you know, there's that loss of trust, and that can take ages to unravel.
Viv, thank you very much indeed for that. That's Viv Evans, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the charity AdFam. Our apologies, our line wasn't particularly clear, but I hope that we managed to get our messages across. Ron, who listens often to us, says, surely the government should just ban advertising of gambling. You've even got charities like the British Heart Foundation encouraging gambling with their advert, "Go on playing, keep winning." There are quite a lot of lottery type charity offers these days, aren't there? Yeah. Which, you know, you'd be hard pressed to argue that that wasn't going to encourage somebody who had a kind of a gambling problem or was going down the gambling problem road. So I absolutely hear you on that. And I do think these lobbying forces, Jane, with the benefit of hindsight, we realise the incredible damage that they've done, but we don't know about it swirling around us in the ether until somebody exposes it.
We're only about a week or so away from the Grand National, and everything that surrounds the Grand National is about having a cheeky bet. And I'll be honest, I do quite often have a bet on the Grand National. It's probably, I might have a bet twice a year. I'm not a gambling addict. But it's that cheeky bit of fun element around gambling that I think does need to be questioned somewhat, because clearly some people are in the grip of an addiction over which they have absolutely no control and lives are ruined.
And I think now, because so much of it is online, in a way, horse racing is probably going to be the most transparent place that you can be gambling.
Possibly the least of our worries.
Yes, yeah. But, you know, the online gambling where you can just be in your room on your phone and within moments you can have lost all of your paycheck and then some. That's the incredibly troubling thing, isn't it, now?
It is absolutely terrifying. Do send us a message if you've got something to throw into this debate. We can certainly keep you anonymous if that's what you'd like this afternoon. 0333 003 2353. Our big guest after 3:30 is the Times Radio Breakfast co-host Stig Abel, also a novelist. His latest crime book is out next Thursday. We're going to talk sport with Vassos next. It's Times Radio. It's 20 past three.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Like a faithful friend, Times Radio Breakfast will be on air from 6 with everything you could possibly need to know.
Donald Trump is speaking while you sleep. We'll tell you what you need to know, and we'll watch the mission of Artemis 2 after it launches.
Plus, we'll get the best letters to the Times of the week, and we'll talk through the news of the day with Times columnists Fraser Nelson and Cindy Yu.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel. Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Feel that? That little buzz of excitement? That's the weekly flutter. With chances to win up to £10,000, enter British Heart Foundation's lottery for a thrill with goodwill behind it. Because when you play, it helps fund life-saving research. So go on, keep playing, keep winning, keep us beating. Search BHF Lottery. Gamble responsibly. Over 18s only. T's and C's apply. Please see our website for more details. British Heart Foundation is a registered charity.
Young people today, can they really handle responsibility? Or are we just kidding ourselves?
Welcome to McDonald's.
And a mayo chicken.
Some think young people can't manage. We disagree. That's why one in three McDonald's managers are under 25.
Hey, Kira.
Hey, girl. How are you?
Right? Yeah, I'm good. It's busy out there, though.
Like Kira from South London. She's 23 and manages a team of 20.
Let's go.
Leadership. Making it happen at McDonald's.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Vassos Alexander is here. He leads a life of self-denial. Given up chocolate for Lent.
I'm absolutely sick of this. Lent has gone on long enough. I was thinking this morning, we give up chocolate as a family. We sort of always have done. And then, you know, the kids come back from school with, like, you know, tales of I forgot I'd given up chocolate and there was a chocolate brownie and I got it near my mouth and then I had to put it down. I just, it sort of feels like, you know, a little bit of denial is good in the long run. Yeah. And so we sort of, we've started doing that and now the kids are doing it and I'm doing it. But I just thought this morning, for the first time, really just sick of not eating chocolate.
Well, soon your ordeal will be over, won't
and
it?
You offered me a mini egg just now. And if I was going to have any chocolate, it might well be a mini egg. That might be first. That or a crunchy would be first on my list.
Right. Well, you're not going to have one, so that's
not till
that.
Sunday.
Do you want to just carry on talking about it some more? Because I sense you're enjoying just mouthing the words. Crunchy.
We did have a colleague who has allegedly given up chocolate for Lent, but when we had a Colin the Caterpillar, she just had a foot.
That's because...
on the grounds that the white chocolate was on the foot.
Her
nonsense.
Argument was that the chocolate is, you know, milk chocolate. And white chocolate is only just vegetable fat molded into a chocolate shape.
It's actually a good point.
No, it's not. It's factually incorrect.
Vassos is really here to talk about last night's football friendly between England and Japan. And it was at Wembley. And is it the last game that they'll play before the squad is selected? Is
yes.
that why it was significant?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, tell us all about it. What happened?
Here's what happened in another England football friendly. England were terrible. There was much sort of booing and wailing and gnashing of teeth. But actually, I think what you have to always come back to the fact, and I've spoken to a lot of former international players, and they say that you just can't read anything into a friendly. I mean, you can list the players that England didn't have available, not least Harry Kane. And there's a lot of, oh, England are terrible without Harry Kane on the back pages this morning. Martin Samuel said, the sight of England players and management aimlessly milling around the Wembley perimeter looking for a crowd to appreciate was bad enough. The 90 minutes that preceded it, probably worse. Yes, absolutely. Friendlies are awful. Friendlies, if you can absolutely possibly avoid watching international friendlies, please do. The players are largely, especially at this stage of the season, trying to avoid getting injured, which sort of begs the question, does that make it more likely that you would get injured if you're trying to avoid getting injured? But anyway, if you take 10, 15, 20% of just the whole adrenaline out of a player crossing the white line onto a Wembley pitch. Japan, absolutely. They played great and they wanted a sort of trademark win at Wembley. Trademark's the wrong word. A landmark. Landmark
well,
win at
one.
Wembley. And they got one. And Uruguay, a few days ago, they came for a draw and last second they got the draw. Great result for them. But the England players, they weren't just that little bit up for it. And I just don't think you can read too much into the friendly. Not to take away from how just desperate it was. I mean, it was pretty terrible.
Yeah, I did watch a bit of it, but honestly, it was quite turgid. It was very hard to stay awake, to be honest. There wasn't a lot to enjoy. And you're right, of course, nobody wants to get injured. Equally, quite a lot of players are quite tired. But then also, if I'm honest, Vassos, there were quite a lot of players I didn't know playing for England. And that's because the Premier League is the league I watch, and so many of the players are not English.
Yeah, and... Well, look, the thing is, there was a 35 player squad named in a sort of X Factor thing that Thomas Tuchel, the England manager, decided, look, let's and it sort of worked in theory. Let's have one side for the Uruguay game and then a side much more approximating my best 11 for the Japan game. But that doesn't help when, you know, Kane, Rice, Bellingham, Saka, Trent, Reece James, they're all not playing. So that's half a side immediately.
Right.
Playing without a striker and seeing if Phil Foden will work in that. I mean, it's just, I don't want to get too tactical.
Well,
but
I was going to ask you, I was watching the commentary last night, kept making references to a false number nine.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know what that means.
So... A number nine is a traditional centre-forward, play off the back of the defenders and, you know, poach the goal. And a false nine just is, like, sort of behind that. It's just don't worry about it, basically.
I am worried. I watched that last night. I'm now very worried.
No, well, don't... I mean, it definitely doesn't affect... I mean, our March friendlies ahead of the last Euros went pretty badly. And It's all changed. It's the atmosphere in the squad. You talked about, have Greece ever, you know, qualified for a World Cup? Yes, they have, and they've actually won a Euros. Mm. And it was all the atmosphere in the Greek squad of Euro 2004 in Portugal that sort of took them to that ridiculous unlikely victory, which ended up with me dancing around the cathedral in London in the Bayswater area by Bosco Road, along with all the other Greeks in London. It was just great. So then I had to go into breakfast the next morning, and I was just barely had about 15 minutes sleep. Brilliant, brilliant memories. Mm. And I hope that England fans, maybe Scotland fans, you never know, will have memories like that after this summer. But honestly, you can't judge England on a friendly. Okay. Just, I've watched enough friendlies to, you know, there's basically 90 minutes you won't get back.
All right, let's just not get ahead of ourselves. But if he has all the best players available, everybody's fit, come that opening match in June.
And on it, and the atmosphere in the squad, because we know how Gareth Southgate used to engender a really sort of positive atmosphere in the squad. I'm not sure what Thomas Tuchel's is like yet, because you don't really know until you go away for an extended period of time. He's much more the leader, and Gareth Southgate was much more players, just be yourselves and express yourselves. And that worked. So let's see if Tuchel's way works. And if it does, if they're all on it and fit, then there's absolutely no reason England shouldn't win the World Cup.
Do you really think that?
I really do. I really do. And by the way, yes, England lost to Japan. While England were losing to Japan...
Oh, yes. Let's cheer ourselves up.
Italy were losing on penalties to Bosnia, right? And nobody... I mean, I include Greeks in this, because we do hand-wringing pretty well in Greece. But nobody does it as well as the Italians. I've listened to some of these headlines. The third apocalypse... This is the third World Cup in a row that Italy's men have failed to qualify for. In amongst all that, they won the Euros beating us on penalties at Wembley. But let's concentrate on the World Cup. The third apocalypse is the worst of all, writes Gazzetta dello Sport. Things were never this sad, this bad, this small. We are no longer part of football. We count for nothing. It's a national shame. Italy really are hand-wringing this morning. They have failed to qualify for another World Cup. At least we'll be at the party.
Yes, oh, we will.
Yeah. There's something of the we were once an empire syndrome about all of that, isn't there? And sometimes I think that might be what we have too. I think any one of those headlines could equally appear in a British tabloid were we to have the same fate. Ours would be worse, Vassos.
Well, I mean, you remember the Graham Taylor turnip?
Yes.
You know, when England failed to qualify for that World Cup.
Who was the Wally with the Brolly?
And that was Steve McLaren. Bless him. Bless him.
Yeah. So our headline's just funnier, but equally apocalyptic.
Elsewhere. Here's DR Congo, right? DR Congo were aiming for their first World Cup, well, their first World Cup ever as DR Congo. They were playing Jamaica in an intercontinental playoff. And it's huge. I mean, 110 million people in DR Congo. And they feel like they have, they won. They can now right the wrongs of 1974, I think it was, that World Cup, when... So they lost 9-0 to Yugoslavia, they lost to Scotland, and then they lost to Brazil. And whilst Brazil were lining up a free... This is a very famous sort of football clip in grainy images. Mm-hmm. While Brazil were lining up a free kick, one of the then Zaire players just ran out of the defensive wall and booted the ball upfield. John Motson, who was commentating, went, "What on earth did he do that for?" And it just seemed to... It just created the impression that African players didn't even know the rules. And it put sort of the continental football back several decades, actually. And then it was when the World Cup was in South Africa in, 2010, that completely... There's 10 African countries now at this World Cup, which is fantastic.
Well, that's amazing.
Great, great for DR Congo to have another crack at a World Cup, because it just didn't go well last time. Yeah. Iraq are through to the World Cup for the first time in... 40 years, cue lots of, fireworks and kind of gunshots into the air in Baghdad last night, apparently, and lots of loud music and, uniting all the Iraqi sects, apparently. So that's some good. It's nice for the countries who are qualified when it means a lot to qualify.
Yeah, but in Rome...
In Rome, they're still hand-wringing.
The bell tolls.
Yes.
Are you in demand for people's pub quizzes by any chance, Vassos? There's nothing you can't pluck out from the sporting encyclopedia.
I did. Actually, we went to my daughter's school's pub, not pub quiz, but,
quiz night.
Quiz night. Yeah. Quiz night. And we won.
Okay. Well, and that's your anecdote of the day.
I'm not that surprised to hear it, if I'm honest. Vassos, always good to have you. Thank you very much indeed for coming on. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I love coming on.
Right, coming up next, it is Stigable. It's just gone 3:30. Let's get the very latest news headlines with Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. Donald Trump says the new supreme leader of Iran is calling for a ceasefire. The US president says he will consider the idea when the Strait of Hormuz is open, free and clear. Trump also says he's seriously considering taking the United States out of NATO. Member countries have been reluctant to help America reopen the Strait of Hormuz on Iran's southern border. Trump has told The Telegraph that NATO is a paper tiger. The Times' foreign correspondent Richard Spencer was asked if Trump should be taken at his word.
I suspect it's not very serious. I suspect that he has people around him who would stop him doing that. I mean, there are some things that they can't stop him doing. And there are some things that they would encourage him to do. I think people like Marco Rubio, I think they would probably say we do need to have some friends.
Sir Keir Starmer says he will take the UK closer to Europe. Announcing a summit in the coming weeks, he said such a move is in Britain's interest, both defensively and financially. Three more people have been arrested in connection with an attack on four ambulances owned by a Jewish charity in North London. The vehicles were set on fire in Golders Green. Two other people were arrested last week and released on bail. And two teenage girls have been arrested on suspicion of assaulting an emergency worker in southwest London. The Met Police has reported large crowds causing antisocial behaviour in Clapham. A dispersal order was issued last night. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
The UK government is backing businesses with no-fee recruitment support from Job Centre Plus.
I'm Sophie Smith, Chief People Officer at Compass Group UK and Ireland, the UK's largest food and support services company. We need talent at scale across the country fast. We're working with Job Centre Plus to help find great people. Their local employer advisors help us advertise vacancies, connect us with motivated candidates, and last year alone, our partnership drove thousands of applications. We've also created something we're really proud of, the Accelerate with Edgbaston Hospitality Hub in partnership with Job Centre Plus. It's helping us bring local people into real careers. We provide on-the-job training as well as access to a range of apprenticeships from entry to degree level.
I'm Amir. My life changed the day I went to Job Centre Plus. I found my spark.
If you're a business looking to recruit, Job Centre Plus could help you find talent that delivers. Visit business.gov.uk/recruit to find out how. Eligibility criteria apply.
The day's big stories and tomorrow's front pages. Saturday and Sunday nights from 10 with Daryl Morris.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Good afternoon. We are here until 4 o'clock. John Pienaar takes over then, and Kate Borsay after that. It's going to be quite an evening. Donald Trump makes a speech or something at 2 in the morning, which you'll also be able to hear live here on Times Radio. Somebody who'll already be awake and just getting into his kind of quite high quality leisure wear is our guest this afternoon, Stig Abel. Hello, Stig.
Hello. How are you doing?
Not too well. I'm all right because I get up at a very reasonable hour indeed. You, however, have done how many Times Radio breakfast shows do you think you've co-hosted now?
It must be, so it's nearly 6 years. It's four, it's 16 hours a week. It's yeah. Many, many thousands of hours. And actually the Donald Trump impact is very keenly felt because in common, I think, with many of our listeners, whatever time you get up, the thing you do is you check your phone and you say, has Donald Trump decided to end this war or continue this war? And bearing in mind that this war will have massive effects on all of our lives, all of our pensions, job prospects, ability to drive a car. It's not an idle checking of your phone to see how Donald Trump has done. So I've just been talking to our production team about how do you book? We've got to try and book the right guest for what Donald Trump may or may not say at 2 o'clock in the morning. That's a bit, that could be, because it could be we're moving troops into Karg Island and I'm announcing a land war, or it could be I've spoken to an Iranian person who I think is someone in charge and I'm withdrawing entirely.
Yes, the Trumpification of news was something I did want to talk to you about.
Yeah.
But actually, in the last couple of minutes, certainly Sky are reporting that Iran says they haven't asked for a ceasefire. So, I mean, the whole thing is just the usual.
It's a farce. I mean, if it wasn't so serious, it would be a farce. Mm. But it is kind of serious because you do wonder, how to respond journalistically to this stuff, because you've got to report what he says, and what he says has massive meaning. I mean, he's more powerful now than he's ever been. He'll probably be, more powerful till the midterms, and maybe does that wobble him a little bit? Maybe it does. He's certainly more powerful than he was first time up. And so it does matter what he says. But what's so interesting about Donald Trump is he has this ability to turn his assertions into the reality he wants to live in. Except in this situation, reality is going to hit him in the nose at some point, because he can say he's won the war, but he can't open the Strait of Hormuz. He can't assert the Strait of Hormuz is open and make it so. It is either open or not. The oil price is either $120 a barrel or it's $80. You can't change that. So that's what I think is so fascinating in a grim way for all of us, is that he might be able to alter reality in terms of perception among people in America, but reality will have the last laugh in the end.
The fact that at 2 tomorrow morning he'll come up with his usual bombastic piffle. This is piffle from somebody who's fundamentally quite unhinged, which most of us accept now. And then people who aren't unhinged, and some of whom, including you, are actually rather clever, will attempt to make sense of it. But in 10 years' time, we'll look back on this and think, what were we doing? What was all that about?
I think that's probably right. I always call it, everyone says, and we'll be accused of this even in this conversation, the Trump derangement syndrome, which is the syndrome that people support.
I really object to that expression.
I know. Well, I think what actually exists in the world is Trump arrangement syndrome. Because what actually happens is Trump shoots from the hip, says what he thinks, has no strategic planning, often says things that are contradictory within seconds, if not minutes, of each other. And then there's this entire scaffolding of the world erects itself to make sense of it. And all of a sudden you'll have people say, oh, he's weaponized uncertainty, or this is part of a long game that will do this, and tariffs is a way of just starting the negotiation. Then someone will pop up and say he's a deeply transactional person. You hear that a lot. He's the art of the deal, man. He just wants to make a deal. He wants to make a deal. Well, what deal is he going to make with a bunch of crazy, evil, largely Iranians, who he's bombed out of house and home, who found the bit of leverage that everyone said they had, but no one had really tested in 40 years. And look, of a sudden, that leverage does exist. And how do you get out of that? How do you get out of this situation? You can't simply assert your way out of that situation.
Do you think that he's underestimated, and therefore we all underestimate, the very real possibility of huge repercussions on American soil?
I wonder that. I mean, the problem with all of this is the danger in a lot of an analysis of Trump is just because he's making foolish decisions, it doesn't lend virtue to the other side at all. And actually, this is a tyrannical regime. It is a regime that has done all sorts of appalling things. It probably wishes to do all sorts of appalling things in future. And the problem, I always found this when we used to discuss the Iraq war all the time, making bad foreign policy mistakes doesn't justify terrorism, but it will be used to justify terrorism, and it will probably motivate people to consider terrorism. But the danger you then have as you try and analyse that is you try and make that causal effect. It will be used by some people as a bromide, as a justification, and that strikes me as ethically wrong as well. The brutal truth is it's a right old mess, and it wasn't so much of a mess 4 weeks ago as it is now. And how you remedy the right old mess is, I think, a really tricky, tricky thing. And will we know more? If you wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning, we'll tell you what Trump said at 2 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, will that be any clearer? Well, will the situation be better or worse or the same? And we can find out.
Okay. Mike takes issue with my assertion that Donald Trump is unhinged and says he isn't unhinged.
Well, and that's the point. And some people, and this may just be Trump arrangement syndrome, or it might be the madman theory of diplomacy, the fact that he absolutely does things. I mean, if you contrast him with Keir Starmer, Keir Starmer pauses and has a consultation about everything. A point that Donald Trump made not inaccurately about him in one of his rants. Trump does do things. Now, whether he does things with forethought, whether he does things as part of a strategy, I think one is entitled to question quite robustly. But stuff happens under Donald Trump in a way that it doesn't with other people.
Ron has messaged in to say he doesn't want to hear about you talking about Donald Trump. He wants to hear about you, Stig.
Oh, bless your heart, Ron.
Okay, and Stig has actually been booked to talk about his latest Jake Jackson novel, which is out next Thursday, isn't it? Not tomorrow, but
next Thursday.
It's called A Twist in the River, and we're just going to play this. This is Nina Simone.
You know better, Daddy. I can't stand it because you put me down. Yeah, yeah. Spell on you.
She is so good, actually.
Oh, look at you classing this joint up as well.
We are actually
Times Radio's classy show.
Yeah, I've noticed that. I've heard people say that, actually, as well.
Well, they haven't.
To my face.
Nina Simone, I put a spell on you, and we've taken that from the playlist, the soundtrack, to your latest Jake Jackson novel. Now, you'll be flattered to hear that this is the first of your books I've ever read, and it worked for me as a standalone.
Ah, the dream.
Well,
the
dream. Because there are three predecessor Jake Jackson books, and I was a bit concerned myself when this mission fell to me. I thought, will I be able to do this? Will I understand? But it's all right.
Okay, did you enjoy it?
I did enjoy it. I've got some issues.
Of course.
And we'll bring them to...
No doubt you'll tell me about them.
We'll bring them to the
great
table
length
in a minute. But can you, for people...
What about Donald Trump, eh? What's that guy like?
No, we're not going back to him. You're not getting out that easily. For people who haven't explored the world of Jake Jackson, just take us into it. Now, he finds himself in a beautiful bucolic idyll, a home called Little Sky. But how did he acquire it? Who is he and where has he been previously?
So he's a detective who used to work in the city. And I wrote the first book of this when I'd been thinking a lot, as I still do, about the impacts of technology. It was written, the first one, this is the fourth one, as you say, at the COVID period, where a lot of life was about thoughts around the difference between loneliness and isolation and solitude and things like that, the importance of nature and the intrusive, pernicious problems occasioned by technology. And so I thought, I read a lot of detective fiction in my time. I love detective fiction. I quite like old detective. I like books that are written in the 80s, 90s, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. One of the reasons is that technology doesn't intrude upon them. Now, there are some wonderful crime writers who make technology the centrepiece of their crime fiction, which I think is excellent. But my thought was, A, because I think it's an idyll worth contemplating, and B, because it makes the plot more interesting. What if Jake Jackson, whose marriage had failed, got an inheritance of this beautiful farmhouse called Little Sky in a place where there is no internet, no television, no radio, a black spot,
right,
and therefore had the opportunity to experience life without the intrusions of technology, and also experience life without the connections and the pressures of knowing people.
Was he also looking for a life without crime? Because if he was, he's failed.
It's not turned out brilliantly, but in my ideal world, I would just have written Jake Jackson novels with no crime in them at all. But my publishers explained that that's not a very good idea when you're writing detective fiction, to have no crimes take place. So one of the points of the book is actually, can you really escape your past? And even when you say you have principles about not getting sucked into things, being your own person, it's a funny how the world and society and life has a way of dragging you back in. So what continually happens in these books is life in various different forms drags him back in.
OK, I've got a couple of questions for you. Tom says, which city has he escaped from?
I'd never name it.
Yes, well, I noticed that,
yeah,
but Tom is interested.
It's probably, I mean, it's a big city, it's probably London, but I quite like the idea of Little Sky, the place, is not fixed geographically.
I thought it was Norfolk.
I've heard Norfolk, I've heard the Cotswolds,
the Cotswolds.
Derbyshire, the Midlands, I've heard far north. I think the reason I wanted it is because there are some books, again, beautifully written, which are set in a specific place you can go and visit, and that's magnificent. I like the idea of Little Sky being a sort of Arcadia that doesn't quite exist.
All right, now, there are some similarities between you and Jake Jackson.
No, they're not.
Well, first of all, he wears sort of quite expensive leisure gear. But
I don't think that's right.
Well, I've never seen you in formal attire.
I don't own a suit anymore.
You don't own a suit?
I don't own a suit.
Okay.
To make funerals a little tricky. But I kind of feel that if I'm going to go to a funeral, I'll know the person so well, they'll forgive me.
Well, I will say that at the end of this book, Jake attends a happy event. I won't say any more than that.
Oh, yes.
And even then, he's wearing sort of leisure
trousers.
He's
wearing leisure wear. And there are moments in the book where he's not wearing anything at all.
Yes, there are some books. There are some... There
Nakedness
are some...
is a theme in your books, Jake.
I do like a bit of naked. I'm not a naturist, V. I don't want to pretend otherwise. I don't want to claim a virtue I don't possess.
Especially not as we head to visualisation, mate.
Yeah. next year when the fifth one comes out, we'll do this au naturel, shall we?
We won't.
To the cameras.
Please, God, no.
I'm quite interested in... The other thing I love about books, I love physical descriptions. I find the tactility of books the thing... Because I reread a lot. And if you read lots of plot genre novels, which I do, if they're just plot, then it's quite hard to reread them. But the greatest novels, I was thinking of someone like P.D. James, magnificent, magnificent author, And the one of the reasons her books are so good is because they're so beautifully written and there's tactility written into them. And I find that very important in fiction.
OK, just a couple more comments. Emma says, I love Jake. Is he getting married?
Well, I don't know. Don't know about that.
Sure. I tell you what, Candia says, the book is out on Kindle here in the US already. I finished it last night in two sittings. I loved it, and I can't wait for number five. It's your publicity team at work here.
I think
this
they probably
just,
are.
This is absolutely incredible. Sue says, I'd like to tell Stig how much I enjoy his books and what a great style of writing he has.
Okay. Bless your heart, Sue. Thank you, Sue.
Enough.
Don't worry, Jane's about to say something horrible about them now, so we'll get journalistic balance, I think, by the end of the half hour.
I am really interested in the fact that this book does feature, I don't think it's a spoiler to say, at the start of the book, a woman goes missing.
Yes.
And there is pandemonium, as there is often, but not always, when a woman goes missing, and very rarely, actually, when a man goes missing. And that's just something that I do find troubling. And if the woman is, let's be honest, is white and middle class, then you will get lots of press
coverage.
And indeed,
that's a line taken from the book, where Martha, who is one of the people who investigates with Jake, who's this character I've stumbled into and I absolutely love writing, this sort of very cynical figure who used to be in the security services, that she actually makes that point. Mm. That if you look at, I actually looked at the number, it is something absurd. Tens and tens and tens of thousands, hundred odd thousand people go missing every year. Why do we fixate upon the ones we fixate about on? And they're very often white, middle class
Heading towards middle age,
with kids, with a husband everyone's suspicious of. There's a narrative that we all fall into. And in fact, one of the reasons I wrote the book a little bit was because I was thinking about partly the media and the new media and how they report these things. And one of the strains in the book is, what happens to a small village when a thing happens and the whole world falls upon it? That includes us. It includes print journalists, includes broadcast journalists, but now in the new world, it includes real-life podcasters and YouTubers. And I started my career in the Press Complaints Commission, whereas one of my jobs was, when a big crisis happened, I used to help the people at the centre of it deal with the press and try and get the press from not intruding too much into their lives. It's a very difficult thing to do because journalists should ask questions of people and some people want to talk. So none of it's very straightforward, but it reminded me of the scrum and how the modern scrum is a little bit different. So I have a character in this this book who is a YouTuber called Danny, who goes wandering around of her own accord trying to solve the crime.
Right. Now, and of course, she is the kind of character that people with journalistic training are very, very snooty about.
I really like her in the end, though.
Well, I mean, she is an interesting character. I won't say any more than that. But yes, she's somebody who initially, reading the book, I was terribly sniffy about, and then other stuff happens and I reassess.
Yeah.
But, of course, people like that did turn up. I'm not going to mention the name, or I can remember the name of the poor woman who went missing not that long ago.
Exactly.
By a river. All sorts of poorly motivated, certainly not trained people went to supposedly cover it.
Yes.
And it was just deeply, deeply unpleasant for everybody involved, not least the poor woman's family.
And I think, actually, if you write about modern crime, again, some of my crime writing is about idylls and the countryside and things like that, but actually modern crime is a really interesting subject, and technology itself. I mean, technology affects everything we do, including how we consider crime and how crime is investigated. And of course, some trained journalists are awful. And indeed, the pressure of even journalists trying to be good can be awful. And one of the things I learned in the past, even if everyone goes there with good intentions and doesn't knock twice, knocks once, is really polite, if there's 50 of them, it can be terrible. But there's this new breed of people who are very much about the clicks, even more so than journalists are. Yeah. And what happens when all of those people gather together in one small spot? And often it can cause all sorts of problems.
You also have an old school local journalist in the book, don't you?
Yeah.
I mean, that always makes me think about how much we've lost with local papers disappearing.
And one of the joys I have, Joe, I really like her as well. I mean, it's such a dreadful, trite cliche for authors to say, and I don't want to say it, Jane, I don't want to insult everyone. Everyone says all the characters talk to you and that's how you learn how to write these things. You do often stumble there into characters who you just like more than you think you're going to when you start, and you want to give them more words. And Joe, the local journalist, reminds me of local journalists I used to meet when I was in my old job. And, you know, now local journalism, with some exceptions, is owned by big businesses, and all it is tat. And if you ever go to a local website, people who listen will know this, they're almost unreadable. Because the second you go there, four things pop up, and it's stuff that's just been trawled off the internet. It's all about just ad clicks. Now, I think AI is going to destroy that model, and even more than it is now. But at the moment, I don't think what used to be brilliant local journalism exists in the same way.
Okay, I'm going to praise you and not praise you at the same time. Sarah says, tell Stig I love his books. I listen on Audible. I love that Jake likes to have a relaxing puff now and then.
He does.
Very
that's,
well.
That's not like me, actually. I'm a disgusting Puritan.
I wasn't going to mention that.
That's fine.
It's up to you. Sarah's listening in northern Norway. Bob, on the other hand, says Stig's books are okay if you're into bearded men swimming naked in a lake.
Truth.
Now, I always thought that in real life...
And who's not into that, though?
IRL. You're not a big fan of cold swimming. I think you're quite disparaging about the cold swimmer.
Yeah, the wild swimmer. There's that great joke, how do you know if someone's into wild swimming? Don't worry, they'll tell you. Yeah,
well...
But I start from that cynical perspective, but like all things you're cynical about, it's because you're slightly jealous of it, and I suspect I'm slightly jealous of that.
Now, you really worried me, I think it was last year, when you revealed that you only eat one meal a day.
Yes.
Now, there are some, I think you might loosely call them recipes in this book.
Okay. Do you not buy it? I can't remember what's in this one. Go on.
Well, page 252 of my proof copy.
You got that far, did you?
Stig. I've read it.
Well, I know.
Jake grabs some potatoes from the store, bakes them, removes the flesh, and mashes it with cheese and herbs and hard-fried pieces of sausage before returning the mix to the skins to brown that evening.
In the oven? My mum used to do that.
He's having guests round, and that's what he's serving them. I mean, that sounds like me.
Seriously, if you went to a farmhouse and someone rustically pulled out crispy jacket potato skins with potato mashed with cheese and sausage meat, who says no to that? Vegetarian.
What would you say, Pete?
Well, I was intrigued, and I actually did spend quite a bit of time just wondering exactly what kind of sausage you were using there.
Yeah.
Was it a salami base? Is it a chorizo?
I think it's a rustic sausage that I like to imagine hanging down from the rafters. One of my most influential books of my life was Wind in the Willows. You know that bit where they go to Badger's house and Badger sort of cozies up for the winter and he has hanging down from his rafters smoked hams and sausages? That, to me, when I was a kid, was what when I think of food and sort of largesse and like I often think of that. So I like the idea of people thinking of what it would taste like, because I think of that when I read books.
There's a very nice creamy herb garlic dip in there as well, which,
for food fans.
Yeah.
Peter says, hello from Brighton. Jane, Fee and Stig, you are quickly becoming gay icons. Afternoon on Times Radio are pure bliss. Well, we'll settle for that.
Yeah, I certainly would settle for that. Yeah.
Big in Brighton.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about Len Dayton, because he died recently, and you love your crime fiction, you've already said that, and you reread books as well. I mean, Len Dayton was interesting, because he wrote cookbooks too.
He did.
Now, what was his... Well, why was he so good?
So, I read Len Dayton for the first time when I was 8, I think. And I always say this, but I grew up exactly in the pre-technology era, and then my adulthood has been exactly post-technology. So I read... My parents had all these genre novels. And Len Dayton wrote gritty, beautifully written Cold War spy novels, and they just had within them this sort of flex of poetry. So they were very... It was indicative of a time when Britain was pretty much on its uppers. It rained the whole time. The Cold War is at its heart. So it's the opposite of glamorous, and it's still got all the class sort of preoccupations that Britain had in the 70s. But it's just propelled along with this lightness of touch. And I think... Great genre writers are one of the great pleasures in the world, and Len Dayton, for many, many people, offered that pleasure.
The only book of his I've read, I think, is SSGB, which is the counterfactual. Yeah, counterfactual.
Yeah, the counterfactual where the Nazis, where Churchill surrenders to the Nazis and the Nazis take over in Britain. And lots of other people have done that, and he did it very well, but he's one of these people, and my parents had John le Carré and Len Dayton, but they also had sort of hacks like Hammond Innes and Frederick Forsyth, and I remember Geoffrey Archer, do you remember Cain and Abel? Every house had Cain. I mean, you've interviewed me on this programme, Geoffrey Archer.
Yes, yeah.
Do you know, I once did a stage thing with Geoffrey Archer.
Did you?
And, and I interviewed him, and what he did is we were sitting next to each other on a stage, and I asked him one question, and then he just stood up and walked 10 yards to the front of the stage and spent the next 55 minutes talking to the audience. I had to throw questions from 15 yards behind him like I was at the back of a bus.
He once made me cry.
No.
Yeah, and I'm not alone in that, actually. Louise Minchin had the same experience. I mean, he's quite something, that gentleman.
He is. And in fact, he's retiring. He's got his last ever book is out this year, I think, or next year. He's retiring.
Will we cope?
I know.
Somehow, I suspect we will. It's interesting. We have been rereading for our book club podcast of Off Air, A Town Like Alice by Neville Shute. And we were saying earlier, we've never had as many emails, have we, from one of our book club podcasts.
It was intriguing to reread it because very few people who had read it at the time went back to it and had the same feeling that it gives us now, because it is so full of difficult language, should we put it that way, and misogyny. But at the heart is an absolutely cracking love story.
I think the misogyny is interesting. I reread the Morse books. And, you know, Morse, great, you know, great Colin Dexter. And wonderful books. And when you read any books from the 70s and 80s, there is just this cast-off misogyny that I'm sure you guys would have appreciated far more than I did when I reread them. It's not like the books are built around misogyny. It's just there's moments where a woman will be assaulted and it's just thrown away. It's just like, oh, God, that doesn't matter. Or she was asking for it. And it's not 15 pages. It's just two sentences that... It's probably a good thing that they stand out so much now when you reread these books.
Stig, lovely to see you. Lots of messages coming in about baked potatoes.
Who does? Are they pro jacket potatoes?
Baked spuds, mix the flesh with butter, cook leeks and cheddar, stick in back in skins to melt, serve with sour cream and chives.
Done.
Also, it's the combination of food and crime fiction.
Food, crime fiction, nudity. What more do you want?
Stig, thank you. The book is called A Twist in the River. It is the fourth Jake Jackson book. Honestly, it's really quite good, and it takes a lot for me to say.
Bless you. And also, thank you for reading it, Jane.
We've got the Beacon Slaggers off, but we do read the books, don't we?
We put in the hours.
I know, I've noticed that.
And he really, really puts in the hours, and he's doing it from six tomorrow here on Times Radio.
I'll be there.
Right, got to go, because it's 3:30 to four.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
How will NATO allies respond to Donald Trump digging out the UK on its approach to Iran? Julianne Smith, an American foreign policy advisor and former US representative to NATO, joins us, picking apart the biggest stories of the day. Are Peter Hitchens, the columnist and author, and the conservative commentator Albie Amoncona. And we'll also be tracking NASA's Artemis 2 launch around the moon from the Kennedy Space Center.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
You've saved carefully for your future, your plans, your peace of mind. Now there's good news. FSCS protection for your savings and current accounts has risen to £120,000 per eligible person at UK authorised banks, building societies and credit unions. From the very first pound right up to £120,000, it's all protected. So you can focus on what matters with confidence. See what it means for you at fscs.org.uk. Your savings, FSCS protected.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Well, that was Stig Abel. He's going home to get some kip, and he'll have his one meal when he gets back, and he'll be on air tomorrow.
Yes, and any recipes you want to send into the programme, we can do that in the afternoons, can't we? Interspersed with geopolitics, we can handle it, Jane.
I think inventive ways with a baked potato. I do love a baked potato myself. But there's only so much in my experience I can do with them, but I appreciate other people who've got better ideas. Colin wants to know how Jeffrey Archer made you cry.
It's a story for another day. It involved running his prose through a computer and running prose from the Sun's editorial on any given day, and the results didn't please Jeffrey Archer. And he threw what we used to call at school a bit of a fruit loop at me.
Right. So that does sound good, and it will be in Fee's forthcoming memoir. It's almost 4:00. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks to Ryan Boyden. Rosie Cutler organised us after a fashion today. John Pienaar is next.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Fee. At 4:00, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Donald Trump claims that Iran's leadership want a ceasefire. The US president says he'll consider the idea when the vital Strait of Hormuz is open. And Keir Starmer says he'll take the UK closer to Europe, and he talks up measures to blunt energy cost increases. And coming up, we're going to be looking hard at what you might hear in Donald Trump's address from the Oval Office tonight. We're going to be talking politics and the ramifications of the war. Talking to the Minister for Energy Consumers, that's Martin McCluskey. And I'm going to be talking to a student who was asked to spy for China.
This is Times Radio.
And here's the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. Donald Trump says the new president of Iran is calling for a ceasefire. The US leader says he will consider the idea when the Strait of Hormuz is open, free and clear. But the Iranian foreign ministry says Trump's comments are false and baseless. Earlier, Trump said American attacks on Iran could be over within 2 or 3 weeks with or without a deal. Hosro Isfahani from the National Union for Democracy in Iran has told Times Radio he doubts that Trump will cut and run.
I don't think he would make such a mistake and go down in history for losing one of the greatest opportunities that the United States had for finishing the leading sponsor of terrorism. But even if he does that, the Iranian nation has proved over the past 5 decades that they are going to keep marching against the Islamic Republic. We have been doing it since the inception of this regime, and we are going to keep doing it until this regime is reduced to a blip in our history.
Sir Keir Starmer says he will take the UK closer to Europe. Announcing a summit in the coming weeks, he said such a move is in Britain's interests, both defensively and financially.
It is increasingly clear that as the world continues down this volatile path, our long-term national interest requires closer partnership with our allies in Europe and with the European Union. Now we have made progress on this front, on agriculture, electricity, emissions trading, and more. But as the Chancellor has rightly pointed out, Brexit did deep damage to our economy.
The head of the International Energy Agency says the reduction of oil supplies this month will be twice what it was in March. Fatih Birol says the biggest problem is a lack of diesel and jet fuel. He says that's already the case in Asia and will begin happening in Europe this month or next. Regulators are considering whether to bring disciplinary action against a group of lawyers for alleged misconduct over the Post Office Horizons scandal. The head of the Solicitors Regulation Authority, Sarah Rapson, says her staff are investigating up to 25 cases. More than 700 sub-postmasters were wrongly prosecuted for fraud, theft and false accounting between 1999 and 2015 because of faulty software. Three more people have been arrested in connection with an attack on 4 ambulances owned by a Jewish charity in North London. The vehicles were set on fire in Golders Green. 2 other people were arrested last week and released on bail. And the BBC says it sacked former Radio 2 breakfast presenter Scott Mills after new information about his conduct emerged in recent weeks. The corporation's also admitted it knew about a police investigation into Mills back in 2017. Mills was questioned by police over historical allegations of serious sexual offences, but no charges were brought. He himself has not commented. And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker. John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hi, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Now, 2 a.m. tomorrow morning, Donald Trump speaks and the world will be listening because we have to. A couple of hours ago, Trump announced that he'd been asked by Iran for a ceasefire and he refused because he wanted a deal to open the vital sea route, the Strait of Hormuz first. And that is the opposite of what he said yesterday when he declared he didn't need a deal at all to declare victory and call US forces home. Now, clarity may be too much to ask, but there are so many questions. And maybe you're saying to yourself, oh no, not again. But ignoring Trump simply isn't an option. Not when we're told he'll be addressing his nation on the war in Iran. Not when the big question now is, will the president declare victory in Iran and announce he's pulling the troops out? Or will Trump order US troops to capture Iranian territory, maybe with orders to seize Iran's stores of enriched uranium, and then pull the troops out? And by the way, leave allies, including Britain, to guard shipping on the Strait of Hormuz when and if it opens, and do that as best they can. Well, let's call that option cut and run. Actually, all the options look like cut and run, don't they? Even if the president prefers to call it total victory. So we'll count down the minutes and the hours to President Trump's address in the Oval Office. But first today, there is a long-standing concern to Western powers that suddenly looks urgent. I'm talking about the collapse of the Western Strategic Alliance as it's existed since the end of World War II. President Trump and his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, are suddenly sounding much more serious than ever about pulling America out of NATO. The president has never been a fan. Now, it sounds as if, well,
he really means it. And that is a potentially big, big story. In a moment, I'm going to be talking to Larissa Brown, our defence editor at The Times, about that. And tell me what you think. Send me a text, 8722, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. Now, let's look at that story. President Trump, we know, he can take credit for forcing NATO members up on their spending for defence. It's never stopped him criticising NATO partners, and fiercely, since those partners turned him down on his call for help in fighting the Iran war. France has blocked Israeli planes flying weapons through its airspace. Italy, which is led by a Trump supporter, Giorgia Meloni, has refused to allow US bombers and military jets to land in Sicily. Spain, they won't let America use its military bases for any operation against Iran. The UK, it does allow British bases to be used for what are considered defensive operations. But that hasn't stopped President Trump singling out Keir Starmer for the most scathing of criticism. Now, though, not just Trump, but his supposedly more emollient Secretary of State are casting doubt on even on continued NATO membership. This is Trump, the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, speaking on Fox News last night.
So I think there's no doubt, unfortunately, after this conflict is concluded, we are going to have to re-examine that relationship. We're going to have to re-examine the value of NATO and that alliance for our country. Ultimately, that's a decision for the president to make, and he'll have to make it. We're going to finish the job here. As I said, we're very, very close to achieving our objectives on all of these things that I've outlined. But I do think, unfortunately, we are going to have to re-examine whether or not this alliance that has served this country well for a while is still serving that purpose.
That's pretty strong stuff coming from Marco Rubio. Now, after years of publicly doubting the value of NATO membership, but until now, ultimately saying that America was staying inside the NATO tent, the president wrote this in a Truth Social post. Now, we voiced his exact words up for you using an AI program.
All of those countries that can't get jet fuel because of the Strait of Hormuz, like the United Kingdom, which refused to get involved in the decapitation of Iran, I have a suggestion for you. Number one, buy from the U.S. We have plenty. And number two, build up some delayed courage, go to the Strait, and just take it. You'll have to start learning how to fight for yourself. The USA won't be there to help you anymore.
And that was the voiced-up words of Donald Trump. He was actually speaking in a social media post. We can talk now to Larissa Brown, the defence editor at The Times. Welcome to you, Larissa.
Thanks, John.
Thanks for joining me. Clearly, Larissa, we really need to take seriously now the possibility that President Trump doesn't just shift priorities away from the defence of Europe in NATO, but actually pulls out.
Yes, and actually, speaking to people today, you know, we have often had these conversations over the last few years about the potential for this to happen.